Iran says until the sanctions against the country are not removed, it's not reasonable to expect more restraint and forbearance from Tehran. France warning Britain against exploiting the migrant crisis politically after 27 people, including women and children, drown in the English Channel seeking to cross to England. Plus, the Interpol appoints an Emirati general accused of torture and human rights violations. Its new president, that is despite widespread opposition from rights groups. Live from Tehran, this is World News. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal are set to hold talks in Vienna next week. Now, Tehran signed the negotiations are a chance for the United States and the remaining signatories to prove their genuine intention. Now, to do that, the other side should get back to full implementation of their commitments through removing all inhumane and illegal sanctions effectively. That, according to the acting head of the Iran mission in Vienna, Mohammad Reza Qaibi. He made a comment in a statement addressing the International Atomic Energy Agency. He said that the sole cause of the current problems regarding the nuclear deal is the 2018 U.S. withdrawal and its reimposition of sanctions. He also criticized Europe for failing to acknowledge that. Qaibi defended Iran's remedial actions, saying that they were within the framework of the nuclear deal. A correspondent in the Austrian capital, Malazgi, joined us a short while ago and told us more about Iran's position ahead of the upcoming talks in Vienna.
The Iranian representative here, Mr. Qaibi, in his address to the board, did say that the new administration is looking for result-oriented negotiations, that it has a pragmatic approach, and it is calling for the unconditional removal, effective removal, of all the U.S. sanctions, and this is the aim. So he said the purpose of the group that's going to come to Vienna from Iran is to have these U.S. sanctions removed immediately without any conditions, and it wants that to happen in order for Iran to be able to come back to full compliance. Iran believes the current administration has not effectively backed away from the previous Trump administration's excessive or maximum pressure policy and is still in practice continuing that policy against Iran, and the Islamic Republic would only take action when it sees that effectively this administration is taking steps to remedy that situation.
Iran and Iraq have concluded the first session of a joint committee mandated to investigate the U.S. assassination of their top anti-terror commanders. A joint statement issued following that two-day meeting in Baghdad condemned the U.S. move as a serious crime, a human rights violation, and a breach of international law. It also called the assassination a violation of Iraq's national sovereignty. The panel pledged to take all legal and judicial measures possible to bring perpetrators and the orchestrators of this terror act to justice. The next session of the committee is set to be held in Tehran within a month. Iran's top general Soleimani and senior Iraqi commander al-Mohandes were assassinated in a U.S. drone strike at Baghdad airport in January 2020. Tensions escalating between Moscow and the West, with Germany warning Russia of a heavy price if it threatens the sovereignty of Ukraine. Chancellor Angela Merkel says that the EU should be united against Moscow's troop deployment near eastern Ukraine. She says that Russia must face further sanctions if it continues its, quote, weaponization of migrants against Poland. Meantime, the Ukrainian foreign minister has warned Moscow against any military action against his country.
Moscow must clearly understand what political, economic, and human losses it will incur in the event of a new stage of aggression. Ukraine stands for the set of comprehensive measures to counter the Kremlin's aggressive intentions. It includes political and economic restraint of Russia and military aid for Ukraine.
Now, Dmytro Kuleba claims that the Kremlin is trying to dismantle the security architecture of Europe. Russia has repeatedly dismissed Western concerns about its troop buildup near the border with Ukraine. It says the increased military activity is a defensive move that's in response to the growing NATO presence near Russian borders. It also denies any involvement in the current migrant crisis on the border between Poland and Belarus. French President Emmanuel Macron is warning the United Kingdom not to use the death of dozens of immigrants for political purposes. In a phone conversation with British Prime Minister Johnson, Macron said that the two sides share responsibility for the incident. He said that he expected Britain to fully cooperate in the investigation. Now that, as the two countries have traded barbs over the deaths, London has accused Paris of not doing enough to stop the migrants. The European Union commissioner also called the deadly boat accident a tragedy and asked European countries to act more rigorously in fighting migrant smuggling.
How sad we are for a person, every single person, that actually loses his or her life on this dangerous journey. It's a tragedy for each life that is being lost. That's why it's so important to prevent those extremely dangerous journeys. That's why it's so important to fight the migrant smugglers. Of course we need a European cooperation and need to help and support to prevent these kind of tragedies from happening.
The EU Home Affairs Commissioner said that she has come up with a new action plan to resolve the issue. At least 27 people drowned en route to the UK after their boat capsized in the English Channel Wednesday. Police have arrested five people in connection with the accident. Now China renewing warnings to the U.S. over Taiwan. Beijing says it has no room for compromise over the island, and Washington should not have any illusions about it. The Chinese Defense Ministry spokesman says this country is willing to maintain collaboration with the U.S., but the American side for some time has said a lot of what it calls irresponsible and provocative things on Taiwan. Wu Qian says that China is opposed to the violation of its sovereignty and core interests, adding that the Taiwan issue is a special one for Beijing. And that's because China views the island as its own territory. The U.S. government has been irking China by forging ties with Taipei through arms sales and official interaction. Beijing believes that a U.S. measure is emboldened Taiwan and its push for independence from China. Now, in India, recent years have witnessed a growing religious intolerance across the subcontinent, especially against Muslims. Calls are growing now for new legislation against the growing Islamophobia to safeguard the community and uphold communal harmony. Munawar Zaman reports.
It was not long ago when protests against the new citizenship law in India sparked dramatic social and political movements. Citizens united, irrespective of their faith, called for revoking the law. In recent years, India has seen a remarkable rise in violence against the religious minorities, especially Muslims. Now calls are growing for legislation to protect the communal harmony.
Since this government came to power, the hatred among Hindus and Muslims started and polarization on communal lines is taking place. Incidents of mob lynching have increased. Even the government is curtailing the fundamental rights of the Muslims.
With election fever heating up in the largest and most populous state of Uttar Pradesh, anti-Muslim rhetoric is also flaring across the country. Minority communities, especially Muslims, are again becoming political tools ahead of polls. Critics have accused the ruling BJP party of polarizing the country on religious lines for political gains.
Since few years, some right-wing elements have started abusing, insulting Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and the government is not acting against them. Therefore, we demanded a law on blasphemy, which should cover all the religious figures of all the religions.
Despite being the citizens of the world's largest democracy, Muslims in India are apparently having challenging times in Prime Minister Narendra Modi's new India vision. Since 2014, there has been a growing fear and panic among the minorities amid an alarming mistrust of the ruling BJP. The ruling party refutes all critics, saying India is a champion of democracy enshrined in equality for all. Based on reports by rights groups, the ruling BJP in recent years has adopted many laws and policies that legitimize discrimination against the religious minorities. The ruling BJP is also accused of using draconian laws to target and silence its critics. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Interpol appoints an Emirati general accused of torture and human rights violations as its new president, and that's despite widespread opposition from rights groups. The International Criminal Police Organization says that Ahmed Nasser al-Raisi, who currently heads Emirati security forces, was elected following three rounds of voting. Rights groups accuse him of being part of a network that systematically targets peaceful critics. There are also two British men, formerly imprisoned in the UAE, who recently filed legal complaints against the general accusing him of torture. The designation follows UAE's generous funding for Interpol. Abu Dhabi is also accused of exploiting the global police agency to persecute political dissidents. Germany's COVID death toll has surpassed 100,000 as the country is battling a fresh wave of rising infections. The death toll jumped on Thursday after the country reported 351 new fatalities. The rising infections are causing a health crisis, with ICUs being filled up. Health officials saying that some hospitals are facing what they call an acute overload, making it necessary to transfer COVID patients abroad. Germany's already tightened restrictions. While they include requiring people to prove they are vaccinated, cured, or have recently tested negative for COVID before they can travel on public transport or go into the workplace. The country is now considering a full lockdown and mandatory vaccines. The European Commission has outlined how rising COVID cases across the 27-country bloc are creating economic uncertainty. Labor shortages, energy prices, and high inflation rates are also contributing to a gloomier economic outlook. Our Brussels correspondent has a report.
Across most of Europe, the weather has turned colder and wetter. Concern is growing that the coronavirus will thrive this winter, leading to nationwide lockdowns and even greater financial misery.
New risks are emerging, many of them on the downside. Evolution and spread of the virus to start with. As we know, cases are on the rise in many parts of Europe.
The European Semester Autumn Package was presented by the EU Commission on Wednesday. The report highlights how government spending is too high in 15 of the bloc's 27 nations. Energy costs and inflation are too high also.
Partly due to the present crisis, in a certain number of member states, youth unemployment has increased. It's three times higher than overall unemployment.
The Commission is calling on EU countries to retrain people to solve the problem of staff shortages in sectors such as health and construction. It's clear the current situation is difficult for the bloc's youth.
A lot of young people think about suicide. A lot of young people think to the crime, to sell drugs, and that's a big problem for the society.
People don't even have money to buy heating, so indeed, we know that it's not the same Europe that maybe our parents had experienced, something that was evolving and getting better. There's a stagnation for sure.
EU lawmakers have been debating the bloc's social crisis. They warn of political consequences if leaders don't provide greater support for citizens. And it's in this context many analysts are saying the next few months could be make or break for the EU. Jerome Hughes, the European Parliament, Brussels.
Elsewhere in Europe, France's presidential election campaign is heating up, but the left and center appears to be totally absent from the race. Three candidates are vying for the two spots in the final round, and they all feature policies dominated by far-right ideas. Rami Mazahari reports.
France's presidential election is less than 5 months away, and it appears to be a three-way race for the two spots in the second round. Despite a term marred by the massive repression of the Yellow Vests and soaring economic inequality, incumbent Emmanuel Macron retains a hardcore base of support of around 25% and seems certain to reach the second round. Marine Le Pen lost the 2017 election to Macron by over 30 points, garnering just 34% of the final vote. The head of the far-right National Rally Party has been investigated but never convicted of hate speech. Far-right pundit Eric Zemmour hasn't officially declared his candidacy, but he has been convicted twice of hate speech and investigated 16 other times. Zemmour's popularity has surged the past 2 months, and he and Le Pen are in a dead heat for the second spot. One group which isn't likely to play a major role is France's left, which has never polled so badly at this point in the election cycle. France's left and center-left combined for just 15% of voter intentions, while the centrist Greens only garner 7%.
He has really made the debate about make France great again, to quote the Trumpism, about France first, about protecting its borders, about promoting France, about stopping immigration. In other words, everybody from left to right are answering to the questions that Zemmour has raised.
The very latest polls show Zemmour dropping in credibility, but French voters may continue the Western trend of choosing candidates detached from mainstream politics as usual.
Everybody's asking, will it be Le Pen? Will it be Zemmour against Macron? If it's one or the other, Macron is sure to get reelected once again. Let's not forget he got elected with 23% of the popular vote, and he got 80% of the parliament almost, with little over 20% of the vote because of the French electoral system, the way it works. Macron never really had a mandate, but it's this division that could get him elected.
The irony is that the Yellow Vests have overturned French politics by espousing a program which is universally agreed upon to be genuinely left-wing, and yet it appears certain that the final two candidates will be on the far right, either politically, economically, culturally, or all three. Rami Mazaheri, Paris.
At least 8 people have lost their lives in a car bomb attack in Somalia's rest of capital, Mogadishu. Some 24 people, including 13 children, have been wounded in that blast, which was reportedly followed by gunfire. According to officials, the target was a United Nations convoy passing in the city center. The explosion caused material damage to a nearby school and hospital. This is the latest attack on the Horn of Africa nation that has been claimed by the Al-Shabaab terrorists. The group frequently carries out bomb attacks in Mogadishu as part of their struggle to establish their own rule in Somalia. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. Conservative MPs are increasingly worried about British Prime Minister Boris Johnson's competence and drive after he gave a rambling speech to business leaders and was accused of losing his grip over a series of key policies from social care to rail. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Aubrey Allegretti, Rowena Mason, Joanna Partridge, and Rob Davis. The piece is titled, Johnson Losing the Confidence of Tory Party After Rambling CBI Speech. Conservative MPs are increasingly worried about British Prime Minister Boris Johnson's competence and drive after he gave a rambling speech to business leaders and was accused of losing his grip over a series of key policies from social care to rail. Senior members of his own Conservative Party said they needed Boris Johnson to get the government back on track after a disastrous two-week period amid dismay about his performance at the Confederation of British Industry CBI conference, where he lost his place in his speech for about 20 seconds and diverted into a lengthy tangent about Peppa Pig. The Prime Minister was also facing a substantial rebellion over his social care proposals. Anger at the decision to scale back rail improvements for the north of England, and frustration over the government's failure to keep its promises on small boats crossing the Channel. It caps a difficult fortnight for the Prime Minister after he admitted he crashed the car into a ditch in his handling of the Owen Paterson lobbying scandal. Nervousness among Tory MPs about No. 10 Downing Street intensified after one Downing Street source told the BBC there was a lot of concern inside the building about the Prime Minister. It's just not working. Adding that the Cabinet needs to wake up and demand serious changes, otherwise it'll keep getting worse. A former Cabinet Minister also told The Guardian that there was an accumulation of things building up really relating to his competence, and that is beginning to look very shaky after a pretty bad fortnight. He said it was unlikely to result in a leadership challenge while opinion polls were still fairly even between the Tories and Labour, but it could be problematic for Boris Johnson if that changes when an election is looming. Another senior backbencher said Boris Johnson's CBI speech had been a mess, while a third Tory MP said, "I thought today's performance was the most embarrassing by a Conservative Prime Minister since last week's Prime Minister's questions. Someone needs to get a grip. He's losing the confidence of the party." Another Conservative MP referenced the process by which MPs can submit letters of no confidence to the chair of the 1922 committee, Graham Brady, saying, "It might not only be Father Christmas postbag filling up towards the end of the year. Sir Graham Brady could find he needs a bigger one too." The Prime Minister's speech on Monday, 22nd of November, met a frosty reception among business leaders over its lack of substantial policy. In a sprawling address, Boris Johnson lost his place and spent 20 seconds uttering "Forgive me" three times as he shuffled the printed pages on his podium. He then revealed he had spent Sunday on a trip to Hampshire's Peppa Pig World, an amusement park dedicated to a children's cartoon character, using it for a series of digs at the BBC and at civil servants. He said the TV show, worth £6 billion, was rejected by the BBC and has now been exported to 180 countries. He added, "I think this is pure genius, don't you? No government in the world, no Whitehall civil servant, would conceivably have come up with Peppa Pig." Boris Johnson also imitated the sound of an accelerating car with grunts that the official Downing Street release transcribed as "room, room." And another point, he compared himself to Prophet Moses over his plan to help business invest in tackling climate change. The Prime Minister said, "I said to my official, the new Ten Commandments were that thou shalt develop industries like offshore wind, hydrogen, nuclear power, and carbon capture." After the speech, business leaders questioned the Prime Minister's focus. Mike Cherry, the national chair at the Federation of Small Businesses, said, Last week's HS2 announcement has left a lot of small business owners wondering if the government is already losing its way, not just in speeches, but with regards to levelling up in the round. After the speech, Boris Johnson was asked if he was okay by a journalist. The Prime Minister defended his performance at the CBI, saying, "I think that people got the vast majority of the points I wanted to make, and I thought it went over well." Monday evening, 22nd of November, around a dozen Conservative MPs from the 2019 intake glumly gathered in one of their parliamentary offices. They were said to be disappointed and disillusioned and shared discontent that Boris Johnson wasn't listening to feedback. Like business leaders, the main concern of Conservative politicians was Boris Johnson's failure to live up to expectations on policies such as levelling up, rail and social care. Up to 20 Conservative MPs were expected to rebel on changes to the social care cap on Monday night. Shortly after Boris Johnson's speech, the Labour Party leader Keir Starmer set out to business leaders what he called Labour's pro-business agenda, including closer trade and regulatory ties with the European Union. Keir Starmer said, "I think that sometimes, if I may say so, our party has come across as thinking that business is to be tolerated in some way, but not to be celebrated as a good in itself." The Labour leader told another gathering of the CBI's multi-venue conference, this one in Birmingham, he said, "That mindset has changed under my leadership."
First methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now let's listen to Sheikh Salim Bimji.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Amma ba'd faqad qala Allahu al-Hakim fi kitabihi al-mubin. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Ya ayyuhan nas inna khalaqnakum min dhakarin wa untha wa ja'alnakum shu'uban wa qaba'ila lita'arafu. Inna akramakum inda Allahi atqakum, inna Allaha alimun khabir. Tonight, the topic that we want to reflect upon is culture versus religion. How to navigate the maze. And the verse I began with is a very famous verse that we have spoken about in the previous nights when we looked at the topic of racial discrimination within Islam, about racism and what the Islamic approach is. And I want to take blessings from the same verse to guide our discussion tonight. The verse, as we know, comes from Surah Al-Hujurat, chapter 49, the chapter known as the chapter of the chambers, verse number 13. And it's a very famous verse. I'm sure we've all read it millions of times. We've heard it. We've hopefully memorized it, where Allah says, Ya ayyuhan nas, O humanity, inna khalaqnakum min dhakarin wa untha. We have created you, humanity, from two people, from a male and a female. وَجَعَلْنَاكُمْ شُعُوبًا وَقَبَائِلًا. And then from those two, from Adam and Eve, and from their children and their progeny, we have spread you into various tribes. nationalities, various identities, various skin colors, various languages. Why did Allah do this? Why give us multiple cultures to follow or multiple cultures to engage with? He says, لِتَعَرَفُ, so you may get to know one another. You may get to recognize and enjoy the diversity, the various cultures that each of you have. And then he says, what? إِنَّ أَكْرَمَكُمْ إِنَّ اللَّهِ أَتْقَاكُمْ. Indeed, the most noblest, the greatest of you in the presence of Allah, in the presence of God, is not the one who has the whitest of skin, the one who has blonde hair and blue eyes, or the one who has black hair and dark complexion. It's not whoever speaks the best Arabic. It's not any of these characteristics. It's inna akramakum indallahi atqakum, the one who has the most taqwa, the piety, the reverence of God within their lives. And inna allaha alimun khabir, Allah knows all. He has full awareness of all that you and I as humanity do on the face of this earth. Today, almost 90% of humanity follow religion, whether it be Christianity, which is the number one followed religion in the world, or Islam, the number two followed religion, or things like Hinduism or Buddhism or any of the other ideologies, whether they be Abrahamic or they be man-made religions. 90% of humanity today follow some creed, some religion. We have to ask ourselves, why did Allah, God, send religion to humanity? Why would He go through the actions of sending prophet after prophet, messenger, imam, sage, wali, all of these individuals? Why would Allah do all of this? Was the goal to teach the followers what kind of food to cook? What color of clothing to wear? What was the purpose behind the sending of all of these prophets and messengers? Was it just to teach us how to lead a societal life? Or was it something deeper than that? You look at the Quran. You look at the five Ulul Azam prophets, the prophets of firm resolve. Nuh, Ibrahim, Musa, Isa, and Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam wa alayhim wa salam. These five prophets, what did they come for? Did they come to teach us what kind of food to eat, what color of clothing to wear, how to tie our shoes, how to brush our teeth, what time to brush our teeth? Or did they come for a greater purpose? Tonight, in this topic of culture versus religion, how to navigate the maze, I want to delve into this topic because it's very pertinent, as all of the topics that I think we've been going over these last nights are relevant. And unfortunately, many times, because Islam is in the middle, Islam gets pulled in multiple directions, because sometimes we cannot differentiate, we cannot separate religion from our native culture. We can't separate Islam from where we came from. And so many times our youth get pulled in different directions, and unfortunately we lose many of them because they can't be like their family back home, and they're maybe not fully acceptable in this society. And so something has to give, and usually what it is that gives is their religious identity. And so I want to try to somehow go over some of the challenges that we face, how to navigate this maze, this confusion that we are sometimes putting ourselves into for no reason other than the fact that we haven't really sat back and thought about what is culture, what is religion, and how do you and I reconcile those two, those two massive foundations, those two massive pillars in our lives with where we live today. Now, we as a Muslim community, wherever we come from, we know that we as Muslims are not a monolith. We're not one type. We're not homogenous. We are very diverse. We have Muslims who are native to Spain, just as we have Muslims native to China, and I've met them. We have Muslims who are from Iraq, obviously. We have Muslims from Russia, and I've met those. We have Muslims from countries like South Korea. And we have Muslims from the Caribbean, from Jamaica, from Trinidad, from Guyana. Obviously, they had come to those countries from India hundreds of years ago. And we have Muslims from every country in the world. So we're not a monolith. We're not homogenous. We're not one type. We have Muslims from all over the world. Two things I want to put within our hearts and our mind as I move on in this discussion of how do we understand our position as Muslims who are living in a Western country, in a non-Islamic, non-Muslim, secular environment. Two things I want to begin with. One is that the beauty of Islam lies in its unity and its diversity. Meaning that as Muslims, whether we are from Iran or Iraq, from Afghanistan or Pakistan, from Africa or Asia, from Europe or America, we are united in our belief in God, in our belief in the Prophet, in our acceptance of the Ahlul Bayt, in our acceptance of the Quran, and all of the other actions and the belief system of this religion. That is what we're united in. We're a united nation in that sense. But at the same time that we have unity, we have diversity. Just as the Quran said in Surah Al-Hujurat, وَجَعَلْنَاكُمْ شُعُوبًا وَقَبَائِلًا لِتَعَرَّفُوا. In the unity, we have diversity. We have black-skinned Muslims. We have blonde-skinned with blue eyes and blonde hair who are Muslims. We have Muslims from, again, from countries like China. We have this great diversity of Muslims, but we're still united as one collective body. As the Prophet would tell us in the traditions, that, you know, as Muslims, we are like one fortified body. We are like a human body. And if one part of the body gets sick, then the whole body should be complaining, or the whole body does complain. And as Muslims, because although we are diverse, we're united. So when our brothers and sisters in another part of the Muslim Ummah are hurting because of oppression, because of government crackdowns, like we see in Kashmir today, like we see in India today, like we've seen in Afghanistan or Iraq, or what we've seen in Yemen or in Bahrain or in the Hijaz or in Europe, wherever we see Muslims suffering, we over here in Canada feel that pain. We feel the grief that they're going through because we have that level of unity. So that's point number one, is that although we are diverse, but we are still united.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
روحي كريم عظيم عليم حليم حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صل عليه.
This is IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Basij in view of Ayatollah Khamenei. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. We are in the Basij week. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, issued the formation of Basij volunteer forces on November 26, 1979. This order clearly showed the Imam's foresightedness, as no war had been waged yet. At that time, saboteurs and insurgents would instigate chaos and terrorist acts in the country with the support of foreign powers, especially the U.S. Imam Khomeini, who always relied on people's power, called on them to come to the scene again to thwart the threats. Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said about Basij, "The anniversary of Basij formation is reminiscent of the glorious memory of combatants who, during the eight-year imposed war, drew the most beautiful paintings of self-sacrifice with nobility and humbleness, coupled with bravery and valor. It is the memory of chaste and valorous men who were the lions of day and ascetics of night, who mixed the battlefield against the Satan with the struggle against the soul, prompting to evil, and turned the war front into the mihrab of worship. They are the young men who left their youthful pleasures and desires for God's sake, and the elderly who preferred the battlefield to comfort, and the men who sacrificed the love of wife, children, friend, and land in the altar of divine love. It is the memory of the great men who, with little show off, embarked on defending the divine values and were not scared of the bogus awe of the powers which had come to fight the divine values for preserving the culture and values of the ignorant West." The foresightedness of Imam Khomeini in formation of Basij volunteer organization yielded fruit, as less than 10 months later, the Iraqi Ba'athist regime staged an all-out war against the Islamic Republic of Iran at the behest of its masters in Washington. Saddam Hussein, the former dictator of Iraq, attacked and occupied parts of the Iranian soil to destroy the Islamic Revolution. But the stiff and unprecedented resistance of the Iranian forces, especially the Basiji volunteers, prevented his dream to materialize. Hence, the war took 8 years. Today also, the Basiji forces are firmly defending the lofty goals of the Islamic Revolution under the leadership of Ayatollah Khamenei. Ayatollah Khamenei said, "As long as Basij exists, the Islamic system and the Islamic Republic will not be threatened by the enemies. This is a fundamental principle." The leader believes that the Basij was a sapling planted by Imam Khomeini for the sake of God to serve the people and the Islamic Revolution. And now it has turned into a sturdy and thick tree which keeps bearing fruits in Iran and abroad. This position has been attained due to the divine characteristics such as spirituality, sincerity, popularity, insight, religious awareness, obedience of leader, simple way of living, self-sacrifice, and preparedness. Today, millions of Iranians are the members of Basij to defend Iran and the Islamic Revolution devotedly. Ayatollah Khamenei says, "Basij is an establishment in which the purest men and the most selfless and prepared youth of the country have gathered for the lofty goals of this nation. No doubt, the role of the youth is undeniable in Basij and basically the main structure of this popular organization has been built by faithful and vivid youth. Fortunately, various strata of people have answered to the call of Basij. In every part of Iran, various strata from citizens, villagers, nomads, university students, employees, school students, workers, farmers, and other parts of the country have answered positively the invitation of Basij establishment. Insight is very important for Basij forces. Ayatollah Khamenei says in this regard, "Dear youth, dear Basijis, increase the insight day by day. Do not let some material needs and trivial matters block your insight. Keep your insight and recognize your enemy. The enemy has different tricks, and that nation will be successful who is not deceived." Another feature of Basij is sincerity and anonymity. The Basij forces fulfill their duties only for the sake of God without any expectation. That's why the leader says that a group of the best and most devoted people enter every field that the country and the system needs with their full ability, while they do not want reward and salary and do not seek name and fame. This is very important. Elsewhere in his remarks, the leader says, "Basij is not dependent on money, title, ostentation, or order from above." Ayatollah Khamenei stresses the need for Basij, saying, "It is not that we have the army and the IRGC and another armed force called Basij. No. Basij is the body of a nation that has been trained to take arm and, in case of the country's need, shoulders the biggest and heaviest load as it was seen during the war." According to the military experts, Basij is the most comprehensive, coherent, efficient, and selfless force in the world. Ayatollah Khamenei believes that Basij should always be equipped with the most updated and useful knowledge and technology in every field. He says, "Basij should enter the arena of knowledge ahead of all. You should go and capture the scientific arenas, technological arenas, scientific innovations, and unknown horizons of knowledge. Imam Khomeini also said, "I always envy the purity and sincerity of Basijis and ask God to resurrect me in the hereafter with Basijis, as in this world I am boastful of being a Basiji myself."
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترك همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The unity of Muslims is a definite Quranic duty. This is a part of a speech delivered on October 24th, 2021, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the government officials of the Islamic Republic and foreign participants in the 35th International Islamic Unity Conference.
The unity and solidarity of Muslims is not a tactic in the way as some people now think, that we should be united because of certain circumstances. No, it is a matter of principle. The cooperation of Muslims is necessary. If Muslims are united, they will help each other and all will become strong. When this cooperation exists, even those who want to interact with non-Muslims, which is all right, will enter into this interaction with full hands. So the next point is that this is a fundamental matter, not a tactical one. The reason we in the Islamic Republic greatly emphasize the unity of Muslims is that there is a wide gap. Today, there is a constant, serious, premeditated effort to create differences between Muslim denominations and between Shia and Sunni. Today, the words Shia and Sunni have entered the American political discourse.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
What do Americans have to do with Shia and Sunni? For several years now, in American political discourse, the issue of being a Sunni or being a Shia has been introduced. They identify some countries as Shia countries and some as Sunni countries. Despite the fact that they are against the essence of Islam and hostile towards it, they do not abandon the issue of Shia and Sunni. So, such issues exist. They are aggravating the discourse on a daily basis and increasing the misunderstandings. Therefore, we emphasize unity, and this is the reason. As you can see, the puppets installed by the US create discord in the world of Islam wherever they can. The closest example is the tragic, upsetting events in Afghanistan these last two Fridays, where they blew up a Muslim mosque while the people were praying.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.